I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. The topic? Restaurants and rules. Some rules are based on religion.
This makes for an unusual scene in a Manhattan restaurant. A shy 20-year-old dictating the kitchen standards to a humble veteran chef.
While other rules promote health and safety.
But who are these feared rule keepers with the power to shut a restaurant down?
They're not really like food lovers.
Some restaurant rules fall outside the domain of the kitchen.
All civil rights issues have basically, at one point or another, revolved around the bathroom.
For more, tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, everybody. Do you subscribe to Cherry Bomb? If not, now is a good time to subscribe because the new issue is here, featuring wellness advocate and personal chef Sophia Rowe on the cover. Head over to cherrybomb.com to subscribe for yourself or a loved one. A Cherry Bomb subscription makes a great holiday gift and helps support all things Cherry Bomb. Hey, Bomb Squad. You're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb, and I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. Each week, we bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life through conversations with the most inspiring women in and around the world of food. First, let's thank our sponsors, Le Cordon Bleu. If you're daydreaming about culinary school, maybe it's time to say bonjour to Le Cordon Bleu. Learn more about the legendary culinary school's most prestigious professional qualification, Le Grand Diplôme, by visiting cordonbleu.edu. And Bob's Red Mill. Bob's Red Mill is an employee-owned company that's been offering organic, gluten-free, and stone-ground products for decades. You know with Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you're getting flavor-packed food that tastes amazing. Go to bobsredmill.com and use the code CHERRYBOMB25 for 25% off your order. Thank you for tuning into today's show. I hope you've had a good week. I just got back from Seattle, which was the final stop on our Future of Food podcast tour. Have you been to Seattle yet? If not, put a trip on your bucket list. There are so many amazing women on the food scene there and so many great places to eat. We had dinner at Chef Renee Erickson's The Whale Wins. We had brunch at Odd Fellows, a buzzy place owned by restaurateur Linda Dershang. And we finally made a visit to Frankie and Joe's, the vegan ice cream shop founded by Carrie Brunson and Autumn Martin. Don't roll your eyes at the term vegan ice cream. They don't actually call it vegan ice cream. They call it plant-based ice cream, and they make the best plant-based ice cream out there. They use house-made sprouted cashew milk and gum-free coconut milk, so there are no fillers or weird additives. I'd have to say their organic brown sugar vanilla is probably my favorite flavor of theirs. It tastes like the best date shake you've ever had. Don't know what a date shake is? It's dates plus milk and vanilla ice cream. I had one in Palm Springs last year where date shakes are kind of a thing. I digress. But you know, we take our ice cream very seriously here at Cherry Bomb. Anyway, Seattle rocks. And thank you to the Kerrygold butter and cheese folks for supporting our podcast tour. Do you know what else we take seriously? Our Jubilee Conference. Cherry Bomb HQ is abuzz with activity because we're in full-on planning mode for Jubilee 2019, which will take place in Brooklyn on Sunday, April 7th. Early bird tickets are $250 and are available now through January 15th at cherrybomb.com. Have you ever been to Jubilee? It's an amazing day of talks, food, panels, networking, you name it. Definitely consider joining us. It's going to be the biggest and the best Jubilee yet. Are you ready for today's episode? I loved interviewing today's guest, June Lee, artist, chef, surfer, and founder of the beauty line Air NYC. That's E-I-R, as in the Norse goddess, not the stuff you breathe. Though Air is trying to make the air better too, as it's a natural, clean, unisex skincare line with environmentally friendly packaging. June and I start our conversation talking about her time spent cooking at a monastery in upstate New York. During her time there, she learned how to be present and how to be still in the kitchen. I feel cooking is my Zen practice, she said, my meditation. June also shares how her family moved around the world throughout her childhood and teen years. She arrived in Queens, New York at the age of 15 and did not speak a word of English. We'll get to our conversation right after this word from Le Cordon Bleu. Are you daydreaming about culinary school again? Make this the year your dreams become reality with Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Study classic French culinary techniques in cuisine and pâtisserie as part of their exclusive 9-month Le Grand Diplôme and graduate into a world of opportunity. You also can extend your course of studies to include culinary management and dedicated internships. Le Cordon Bleu has locations in more than 20 countries around the world and located within some of the best food cities out there: London, Ottawa, Madrid, Bangkok, Tokyo, and of course, the spiritual home of cuisine and Le Cordon Bleu, Paris. Turning your daydreams into reality is closer than ever. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more and let your culinary adventure begin.
When I was younger, when I was little, we lived with our grandparents. They had the top two floors and we lived on the second floor. And one of the things I love my grandmother, and one of the things that I loved doing with her was following her to her monastery. She was a devout Buddhist, and the Korean Buddhist practice is very different than what I practice today, but just her dedication. And I mean, when I was really young, so what I loved was the food. So I would follow her, and they would do 108 prostrations and pray for all the people and the family members, and just went on and on. And I just would sit in the kitchen and watch the women prepare food, and they would give me little tasks like, you know, stuff the dumplings or marinate this nori or whatnot. So I just loved that warmth and felt like I was part of, you know, something. I was part of tradition, you know. So a lot of Korean cooking and cuisines, it's something that you get transmission from your mom, from your grandmother. It's recipes that Korean cooking is Korean cooking, like the kimchi, how you make, and it's kind of like family recipes that's passed down for generations. And I didn't know it at the time, but, you know, in a way I was in training. You know, a lot of women, you know, they expect you to end up in the kitchen and know how to, you know, as a good wife, quote unquote, they, you know, expect you to know how to cook all these meals, like cuisines and dishes that are traditionally Korean food. And, you know, we left Korea. I left when I was very young. We left when I was 7. So, and I grew up very Americanized. So it's not something that, you know, it was in something that I practiced and or I believed in. But yeah, and later on I found comfort and joy in the cooking and Korean cooking especially. But yeah, it wasn't something that I thought anything of except just spending time with my grandmother. And about 10 years ago, I ended up in this monastery. And it was, you know, during a time that I was just personally, I was having a hard time, just didn't know what I wanted to do with my career. I was in a career that I didn't especially love, and ended up in this monastery by accident, you know, and I hated it at first. I hated the quietness. I hated the nature. You know, my dad is a very outdoorsy person, and I thought I was a city girl, and I didn't like being outdoors, going fishing and going hiking. I just didn't want to be bothered. I just wanted to watch, you know, like TV shows, the hip popular TV shows, and learn how to do makeup or something. So I ended up in this monastery, and part of the practice is doing work. They teach you how to do work in a very mindful way. So how to clean without making noise and just very being still in your body and mind. But some of these work consist of very tedious and not very glamorous things like chopping wood, moving logs, cleaning the toilets, washing the mildew off the showers that's been there for 10 years, you know, and you know, cleaning after people's, you know, stays, their rooms. And I just didn't want, I was not interested in any of those things. And I said, you know, I thought I was getting away with something and said, I want to do kitchen work. So they said, okay, but, you know, kitchen work is actually a very, you have to earn to be in the kitchen. So I said, oh, I have some culinary experience, and I took some classes at the Culinary Institute, so I'm really good at chopping and prepping and whatever.
Was this a true fact?
Yes, it was a true fact.
Good, you weren't lying your way into the kitchen at the monastery.
Yeah. So I really didn't want to be... For some reason, I was really drawn to that place, and I did want to go back, but I really didn't want to clean the toilets, you know? So they put me in the kitchen, and it was very, very hard work, intense labor, because, you know, you cook for a lot of people, like 50, 60, sometimes 80 people, and just washing the spinach, it's like a full day work, you know, production, just getting, and, you know, they do get all the produce from their garden. I did say I wanted to be in the kitchen, and I just immediately regretted it, and the nun that was in charge of the kitchen, they called them tenzos, that's the name of the kitchen, and the person in charge, the head chef. And they are kind of high rank in the monastery. You have to, it's the hardest work that you have to do. And also it's the belly of the beast. You're feeding all the practitioners, and you're kind of changing the mood and the energy of the entire monastery. So it's very important work, and they find it very important that the cooking comes from a place of stillness and practice, you know, this Zen practice. And, you know, I was making a lot of noise and just, you know, I guess I was just excreting all this complaint out of my pores, and, you know, they could feel that. And the first thing, I just felt like I was a child being reprimanded every 5 minutes. You're making too much noise, and you have to wash these giant stainless steel bowls without any noise, and they could hear you from outside, and all the wooden spatulas that you're banging on the pots. You cannot do that. You cannot. You have to be still in your body. If you have a loud body, you have a loud mind. And, you know, I guess I was, you know, really learning how to be, you know, present, just washing these produce. And eventually, I think after 3 years, they asked me to cook. I think she had left. And she had left the monastery and moved on to other things, and they needed a chef, and I just kind of fell into this role. And
so the tenzo had left.
Mm-hmm. So they asked me to do this tenzo for a retreat. So they do have this meditation. They do have these work weekends where anybody, layman of any, just anybody could just, as a first-time practitioners could come and work and be there and kind of absorb this practice. But they have this intense weeks, which happens three times in the summer and three times in the fall, winter. And it's for 1 week. And they meditate from 4 a.m. till 10. And it's 45 minutes at a time and 20 minutes walking meditation. And they meditate all day. And actually, it's easier to meditate than cook for that, because you're cooking from 4 a.m. to 7 p.m. It's wow. Hard
labor.
What
are you cooking?
So you're cooking.
What do you feed them?
It's really funny because, you know, Buddhists and people that practice Buddhism, one of the things that they tell you is you're not supposed to have preferences, but, you know, people have preferences, especially, you know, people that are coming from New York. No gluten, no this. I would have a list of things, and I would just complain, and no garlic, somebody's allergic to this, somebody's allergic to that. And but, you know, mainly is vegetarian cooking with seasonal produce. And, you know, my cooking is very much inspired by, you know, my growing up. So going back to the full circle, so when I became the cook and I had to come up with menus, you know, I at first I wanted to really do a good job and cook delicious food. And, you know, what I started to remember and gravitate towards foods that I remember as a child that gave me comfort, which I didn't really think about in normal life, in, you know, my everyday life. You just kind of, food is kind of like a function of need. But, you know, when I'm in a situation like that where I have to cook and I come up with a menu, and I don't know, I just wanted to bring comfort to the people that are practicing and wanted to, in that environment, recreate food that I remember as a child making and also really enjoying. So actually this practice like really brought my mom and my grandmother really close together, because my grandmother now lives here and she's 88 and has dementia. So it kind of brought all of us really close together, just asking her recipes. Like, remember that red bean soup, you know, with mochi and with maple syrup? And I would have like my modern, like American twist to it, because, you know, and, you know, just like, what else did I would make? I would make like Korean food that are more modern too, like rice cakes, spicy rice cakes, and different kinds of stews, or like bibimbap, which is just all leftover. And another thing that I had to learn how to do in that setting is there can't be any leftovers, and there can't be any waste.
It was amazing.
So, like, if you use a scallion, the ends of the scallion you have to use for creating broth. And, you know, and then I would just, like, make broth, and sometimes the broth would come out really funky because I would, like, put kabocha peels, and I had to learn to and not create waste and not have leftovers. So after day four or something, there would be all this leftover fried rice, and I had to do something that wasn't, you know, because these people that are meditating, they're going through their difficult challenges of facing themselves. And the only thing they have looking forward to is the food.
So no pressure on you. So wait, I'm dying to know, what did you ultimately do, like, with the squash peels and the ends of the scallions? Like, what did you learn to do with all of that?
Well, you know, I have the kabocha peels, actually, they're actually really delicious. And the ends of scallions, I would make sometimes broth, and sometimes I created this like really interesting recipe where I would, basically it was like a garbage disposal. Like, I would take all this leftover salad, leftover kabocha peels, and I would, or leftover soba noodles, because you needed a little bit of starch, and I would put a couple of eggs. It's not vegan, you could use eggs. A couple of eggs and an onion, and I would grind it, and then I would bake it, and then I would serve it with ketchup. And then they said, this is amazing. It tastes like meatloaf.
Oh, that's crazy.
I know. It became one of those dishes that people just replicate it now. And I really look forward to making it. And things like that that you wouldn't think of, like in a restaurant, it's unfathomable that like you would make all this. Basically, it's a garbage disposal and people are just, you know,
consuming
it. We need
to help you think
it.
Of a sexier title for that recipe.
I know.
Than garbage disposal meatloaf, you know.
I know, but when you're making it, people look at it like, what is that? And then I bake it, and then I made this, you know, homemade ketchup, and I served it and with a little bit of bread, and it was their favorite meal.
Oh, I love it. So how did this change how you approach food at home beyond the monastery?
It's interesting because there are times when I just feel really overwhelmed and I have a really hard time cooking for myself, but I do feel cooking for me is my practice, my Zen practice and my meditation. It's something that I look forward to, you know, when I can, and just it's the way I unwind is, you know, it's just really being present for all the ingredients and, you know, the process of it. I find it very nurturing, you know, in more ways than in one. And yeah, and I think it's just, you know, brought a lot of healing in so many aspects. And during that time, actually, it was when I went to culinary. I took some classes at the Culinary Institute, and I was taking classes at the Open Center and studied herbalism. And I would make you know, traditional Korean seaweed soup that they make for you. You have it on your birthdays because it's...
Right. It's in our cookbook, actually.
Oh, really?
We have a recipe from Sohee Kim from The Good Fork down
in Red
Hook.
Oh, that's amazing.
And she gave us the recipe. It's so good.
It's
like
amazing.
You want, in the winter, you want it every day.
Seaweed has just incredible amounts of minerals and just so nourishing to the body, and it feeds and nurtures the depleted, you know, minerals that you need. So they will give it to the, you know, mom just had that gave birth, and since then they give it to you on your birthdays. So they make, it's kind of a tradition. You can't get older unless you have your miyeokguk. It's, my mom is always like, oh, you haven't had your miyeokguk yet. That means you haven't gotten older.
And you're like, I just won't have any for the next 10 years,
10
right?
years. So I started making, I would make things like traditional Korean meals like that, but I would start infusing herbs. Because, you know, a lot of Korean food is very meat-based and fish-based, and the broth is fish and meat. So I couldn't do that at the monastery, so I started coming up with creative ways of, you know, infusing herbs. I would infuse, you know, nettle from the property that I would harvest. So that became a practice of just using herbs and herbalism that I've learned from the Open Center and incorporating it with the cooking that I would do. And during that process, I was also recovering from a couple of injuries that I had from surfing, and just the food, the internal healing, and also I started making balms and oils and ointments. And you know, surfers really loved all the products that I was making, but also the meditators and the ordained nuns and monks, because, you know, they live there and it's hardwood floors and they're sitting all day long and they're, you know, they have issues with their legs and backs and whatever. So they loved all the, you know, pain relieving oils, and they actually really loved this one balm that I made that I no longer make, but I think I'm going to bring it back. It was called antiseptic butter. And they just loved it because they would have to shave every week, and especially in the winter they would shave, and it's just like the head was just so, the dry, you know, air and the cold was just so harsh for their head, and they just loved putting this like beautiful balm. So all the nuns especially, they just loved that product.
So tell me about the name of the line, Air. Where does that come from? Where does the name come
Air,
from?
Yeah, Air, E-I-R. She's a Norse mythological character. She's a healer. She's a medicine woman. And I wanted to find a name like this, and I just looked up for... I was looking for names, and just I found this name, and I just felt that it was perfect. And some people said, oh, it's kind of strange for a skincare line, and should be more... like clean wellness or something. And I just really liked this character. I felt like it embodied me.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with June Lee after a word from our sponsor, Bob's Red Mill. It's time for our Bob's Red Mill Minute. With the holidays coming up, it's time to start baking. And what is better to give and to Instagram than a batch of homemade cookies? From your classic tree-shaped sugar cookie to spicy ginger snaps, the possibilities are endless. This winter, I'm going to take a step outside my cookie comfort zone, our producer Jess came up with that term, and make Lonnie Holiday's chewy miso chocolate chip hazelnut cookies. I need to say that one more time. Chewy miso chocolate chip hazelnut cookies. Lonnie is the Brooklyn-based baker behind the groundbreaking Brutus Bake Shop, where she comes up with delicious gluten-free confections that are so good. I had the chance to interview Lonnie about these cookies in a recent edition of InStyle magazine. Hopefully you saw that. Made with all-purpose gluten-free flour, aquafaba, roasted hazelnuts, and coconut oil, these vegan delights are soft and crispy all at once. You can find the recipe at InStyle.com. Not sure where to get your gluten-free flour? Go to bobsredmill.com to find a wide selection of whole wheat, gluten-free, and alternative flours. There's no better place to get out of your cookie comfort zone. Don't forget, use the code CHERRY25 at checkout for 25% off your order. You know, with Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you're getting flavor-packed food that tastes amazing. And we're back with Jun Lee of Air NYC.
Okay, so let's go back. You were born in Korea and grew up in Korea until you were 7, you said?
Yeah.
And you moved to America. Where in Korea were you?
We lived in Jeju Island and by the sea. And then I...
What was that like?
Like I said, my dad is really an outdoorsy person. He loves the ocean. He loves to fish. He loves to hike. So we spend most of our time just being outdoors and camping. So that was really wonderful. And then we moved to Seoul. And that's when I was, I think, right before kindergarten, we moved to Seoul. And I went to school there and lived with our grandparents in their building in Gangnam, Seoul. And when I was 7, we left. We moved to South America. So I lived in Paraguay for a year, in Santiago, Chile, until I was 15. So I grew up in South America.
And then 15, your parents decided to come to America?
Yeah, we moved to America when I was 15.
Wow. So those are really tough ages to move. Like, I remember being in kindergarten and moving, and it was just devastating to me. But then to move at 7 and then to move at 15, those I feel like those are tough ages. Was it hard on you?
I think the move down to South America, my dad had gone there for a year and a half before we did, and I was really looking forward to seeing him, so that was really exciting. And I think I was really excited for the adventure. It was very shocking I think it would have been one thing to move to Chile right away because it's more metropolitan. But Paraguay, it's wild, you know. It's in the Amazon, and it's just really hot. It's like over 100 degrees all year round, and everything is kind of outside because it's so hot and there's no air conditioning. So your living room is outside, and there's wild creatures everywhere. Like, we would be having dinner, and our dining room was semi-outside, and we would have a light over our dining room table, and all of a sudden there would be this giant moth that would come and just stick to the light, but the moth was the size of a bat. I've never seen anything like that, and my dad, I guess, has seen it before because he's been living there a little longer than we have, and like, he just seems so just nonchalant about it, and we're just terrified because we've never seen a creature that big.
So then why the move to America?
I think, you know, they wanted to seek a better environment, and also it's kind of a challenging question because we had to kind of leave. Like, we couldn't get our visas renewed or green cards renewed, so we moved to America.
So you were 15. You're 15. A teenager.
Yeah.
You land in America.
I didn't speak a word of English.
No, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Where did your parents move to?
To Queens. So it was very confusing time for me because I thought I was total Latina because I was the only foreigner in my entire school when I was in South America. You know, it was very challenging looking the way I do, being that age and just standing out so much. So just grew up thinking that I was just, you know, Latina, and then moving here and having all this, you know, different just cultures and, you know, yeah, it was kind of a culture shock.
Did the Latina students embrace you, or were you on your own?
The Latina students really embraced me, and the Asian students were really confused by me.
Did you eventually find your tribe?
I eventually found my tribe, the artist tribe.
So how did you start surfing?
I was watching some of the surfers in Montauk and just were blown away, and I took a class and took a board out and learned very slowly. It's a really, you know, challenging learning curve, surfing. Yeah, I loved it. I loved it immediately.
I'm guessing the surfing scene has changed a lot over the years, and there are more women out there now.
Oh, yeah. There's so many women in New York, in Montauk especially, and I think more and more women are getting out there, and it's really good to see, and it's good to have that, you know, energy, a female energy and bonding time in the ocean, because I think oftentimes when it's just dudes and it's just one girl, like, it just has this, like, testosterone-filled vibe, and it's not very pleasurable, you know, and it's like very competitive energy. But when there's women, and, you know, I do surf with a lot of women and a lot of really badass, hardcore surfer women, and we have a really good time. Like, for us, it's not about performance or getting better or getting, I mean, we love, you know, riding the waves, and we do feel a little obsessed with it, but it's that being in nature, seeing the whales, or, I mean, you see whales and you see dolphins in Long Beach, you know, just 45 minutes from Brooklyn, and just connecting with your friends and chit-chatting, and it's just so much fun. Like, it's really hard to describe the joy that brings me.
Are you a member of that group, Surf Riders?
Surf Rider Foundation, yes.
Yeah. My brother is part of Surf Riders New York City. And he's been a huge influence on me in terms of the environment.
Yeah.
And a lot that I have learned from him via Surf Riders. We implement a cherry bomb. We implement at the coffee shop I own. And I noticed your packaging is way more environmentally minded than a lot of beauty lines out there. So what came first? Did surfing have an impact on you regarding the environment? Did you just know you wanted a line that was more responsibly packaged? How'd that all happen?
Well, yeah, surfing definitely changed the way I see the environment, because all the plastic ends up in the ocean, inevitably. And a couple years ago, all the microbeads that ended up in the ocean, and all the fish were thinking it was food. And since then, it's banned. But just that was so heartbreaking. And we just see so much plastic bags, so much bottle of just sunscreen and cosmetic products and water, and we see a lot of hair ties, you know, balloons.
Balloons. Oh, my
balloons.
God. I'm like on everybody about balloons. I've banned all balloons from our events.
Balloons will end up in the ocean.
They do. Yeah. And then when I see people let balloons go into the air, I'm like, oh, my God, you hate the planet.
I know. It's really heartbreaking. And it just seeing so much of it. And I do a lot of beach cleanups, that I wanted to create a line of sunscreen that was all the ingredients that are clean, that it's not harmful to us and the sea creatures, because it does get washed out in the ocean or like through our system, through the bathroom. You know what I mean? But I wanted to create products that the packaging itself is sustainable. So, for example, our Surf Moth Pro is a sunstick, zinc sunstick, SPF 50, and it's 100% biodegradable. So if you leave it on the beach or lose it on the beach, it will completely decompose.
That's your cardboard packaging?
Yeah. So people do say, oh, I don't know, it kind of gets damp sometimes, and it's hard to like push it up and push it back down. It's like I tell people really passionately, and sometimes even like upset, that it only costs a fraction of the price to make it a plastic container. But do you see the impact? Like, do you have children that, do you want them to enjoy the ocean in 20, 30 years? There will not be any ocean.
I think everybody has to do beach cleanups. Like, once you do one beach cleanup, it's so eye-opening. As to what is out there, I really think it should be mandatory that everyone on the planet has to do a beach cleanup.
For sure.
Yeah. How's your line going?
The line is going great. We do have some wonderful angel investors that are on board. We're growing so fast, and so we would have this giant order that we need to fill, and like we need money to fill these products and get it out the door, that kind of thing.
Where can people find Air?
They could find it online, our website, and they could also find it in New York at a specialty beauty retailers such as Detox Market, Cap Beauty, C.O. Bigelow's. We love working with C.O. Bigelow's. We're in Anthropology, Urban Outfitters, Shop Full Lane. They're in Massachusetts.
Tell us a little bit about your line. It's not your traditional beauty product line in terms of anything, the ingredients, the types of products.
Yeah, so it's interesting. It has been really interesting journey, because for me, it makes so much sense to kind of marry this recovery and healing aspect and skincare.
So recovery, tell us why you had a surf injury.
I had a surf injury. I tore my labrum and I had two.
What body part is that?
It's a rotator cuff. So it's kind of what holds the shoulder together, shoulder and your arm together. So I tore my rotator cuff and I got really sick from the meds. And I fell on that arm 10 days after my surgery. So I had to have another surgery. So it was about 6 months of just doing PT before getting ready for the next surgery. And just, I went to one of the best surgeons in New York. They deal with a lot of professional athletes. And the things that were being recommended to me were steroids, cortisol shots, Botox. I mean, just really crazy things. And I just felt like I didn't want to do that. And this is my life. And I'm not going to stop being active. And what is the solution? And I grew up with a lot of these like internal healing, homeopathy, alternative medicine, Chinese herbs, kind of my dad does acupuncture and that kind of world. And I wanted to create products that I could use long term that felt wholesome. So I started infusing herbs and putting in essential oils and things that made me feel good and uplifting, like mood lifting, and also helped me with my pain.
Was it shocking to you that the medical establishment didn't talk more about that side of healing?
Yeah, I mean, they just don't believe in it. They think it's just, they're just concepts, but not reality, because there's no data to prove it. But if you go to a doctor in Korea or a Korean doctor, they would say, oh, you know, you could take these meds or you could go to a, you know, herbalist. It's just so part of nature.
But I'm constantly shocked when I go to doctors, especially, I mean, I have decent health care now, but I used to have like amazing health care when I had all my corporate jobs and the best doctors and all that. And they never once would say, like, are you sleeping enough? What are you eating? Are you really stressed? How are you taking care of yourself right now? It was always like a pill or something that they would immediately offer to give you. And I really am excited the more I hear about medicine and alternative medicine coming together. It's taking so long, though, for the two worlds to really meet.
I think so. I mean, I just think that we're just so connected, like internally, our emotions and our energies, our anger, our grief, and it's all, it manifests in our body that, for me, it doesn't make any sense that they should be detached, like one to the next. You know, like if one is going through intense grief and they're having back pain, you know, there is a correlation to that. I remember going through some really difficult time and having like stomach ulcer kind of things, and the doctors were giving like antacid and this and that, and it's like when I went through that process of grief and it went away. It was just as simple as that. And I think more and more people are becoming more knowledgeable and seeking that kind of information and just that kind of connection. And that, for me, I learned a lot about that in my body through meditation, just kind of sitting with it and just working through a lot of the stuff that made common sense.
I want to ask you about your mom. I heard she makes kimchi and soy sauce and has like crocs in the backyard.
I know.
Is this true?
She's amazing. My grandmother, she no longer cooks that much because she has dementia. So she would prep the kimchi and then she'd forget because you have to wait. You have to salt the cabbage and you have to wait a day to marinate it and whatnot. And she just forgets that how much time has passed, so she kind of ruins it. So she no longer cooks, but my mom, you know, they make their own kimchi. She's been doing it for so many years, and they have their own kimchi fridge.
A kimchi fridge?
It mimics the temperature of the ground. Wow. So they used to bury the kimchi in a terracotta jar in the ground. So it mimics that temperature, so the kimchi lasts a lot longer. So they have a kimchi fridge. She has.
Is your mom still in Queens?
Yeah.
I want to picture that kimchi fridge.
I know it's really. I mean, they have like 5 different kimchi kinds in there. So every time I go, I rate it. And they have they make their own miso paste, the Korean miso paste. So that's fermented miso beans. And it takes about 2 years to make the miso paste. And she has a couple of jars going, and she goes, oh, this one is too salty, I don't use it. It's like, it took you 2 years to make it. What do you mean?
That's amazing.
And then during that process, the soy sauce comes from this fermentation process.
So is it true you haven't learned how to make the family kimchi No. yet? What are you waiting for?
I don't know. It's just so much work.
When you can just go raid the kimchi fridge.
Exactly.
Why bother?
She always has so much.
So she makes different kinds of kimchi.
Cucumber kind and radish kind and different kinds of cabbage. And one that's not so spicy, more like watered down version.
It's been so great talking to you. I think you're so inspiring on so many levels.
Thank you so much.
And I wish you all the success in the world for AIR. It's a beautiful line. And thanks for joining us.
That's it for our show. Thank you to June Lee for talking with us. You can find her products online at airnyc.com or in select beauty stores such as Cap Beauty, one of our favorites. I loved what June had to say about cooking at the monastery and about her mother spending 2 years making miso paste. I think the big takeaway here is patience, a good thing to remember in the month of December. Thank you to our sponsors, Bob's Red Mill and Le Cordon Bleu Culinary School. And thank you to our associate producer, Jess Seidman, and to the band Tra La La for our theme song. This episode was recorded at The Wing in Dumbo, a co-working space and community for women by women. For more information, go to the-wing.com. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and Heritage Radio Network. Thanks for listening, everyone. You're the bomb.
I'll have what she's having.
Radio Cherry Bomb is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.